Well, good morning and welcome. Before we get started this morning, because we're expecting a larger crowd, so for both the courtesy of the folks around you and for our speakers and our panelists, if you could make sure your cell phones are turned off at this point, it would really be helpful. Okay. For those of you I haven't met yet, I'm Frank Verastro. I'm Director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. It's my pleasure to welcome you this morning. We're going to explore the topic of energy security, climate change, and transportation, and options for transforming the transportation sector. To be sure, consistent with our economic, environmental, and energy security goals. Today's session is brought to you in partnership with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Darren's here. You'll see him on a panel later today, and with a grant and support from the Rockefeller Foundation. So we appreciate that, and we'll talk more about that later. Typically, we like to open these sessions with some poignant and insightful framing. I'm actually going to save that a little bit because we have a special guest for you this morning, Beth Osborne from the Department of Transportation, and Beth is on a tight time schedule, so we're going to ask her to make some remarks and take some questions, and then we promised that we'd have her out of here by 9:40 thereabouts. So I'll save longer remarks for a little bit later on. Beth was recently appointed as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Transportation Policy at the Transportation Department. She's focused on surface transportation reauthorization, which I'm sure there's many of you in the crowd that are interested in that, the Secretary LaHood's livability initiative, and she coordinates CAFE, tailpipe emission standards, safety, and climate issues. And in her free time, whatever that is, prior to joining DOT, she worked as a congressional staffer on both the Senate and the House side, most recently as Ledge Assistant for Senator Tom Carper of Delaware, where she handled transportation, trade, and labor issues. Before that, she served as Policy Director for Smart Growth America and as Ledge Director for Environmental Policy at the Southern Governors Association. She's a native of New Orleans, and she earned both her BA and JD degrees from LSU. She's graciously agreed to join us this morning. We'll have some public remarks. This is all on the record. Take some questions. And ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to present to you Beth Osborne.
Thanks for having me today, especially on my short time frame. I appreciate it. I'm going to start off by just telling you a little bit about me, and it may sound like it's not related to this at first, but I swear it is. I started out when I came to D.C. as an air quality person. When I was in law school, I thought I wanted to be an environmental attorney, and going to law school disavowed me of the idea that I wanted to be an attorney. But I definitely wanted to stay involved with environmental issues, and when I came here, I worked for Congressman Ron Klink, and he was on the Commerce Committee. We spent a lot of time on criteria pollutants and the beginnings of a global warming conversation. When I went over to the Southern Governors Association, Governor Huckabee and Glenn Denning are responsible for switching me over to transportation. They coordinated on an initiative dealing with the impacts of compact development and smart growth on quality of life and transportation, and I was fascinated by it, and I never went back. But one thing I've discovered as a person who works on air quality and transportation issues during my career is not many people do. And you see that in the development of both the climate change bill and the transportation bill. The folks who work in air quality tend to be very focused on what the Clean Air Act focuses on, stationary sources, utilities, heavy manufacturing. Mobile sources come up in very particular ways, but rarely, and when they do, it's mostly focused on programs like transportation conformity, which a lot of people would argue has not been the most effective program, and most recently, tailpipe emission standards, which I'll get into. On the transportation side, you've got people very focused on transportation, but not focused so much on air quality, and they often see environmental issues as a barrier to getting transportation done. And so you see very different policies in the development of the two bills and almost no coordination. And the coordination doesn't fail just in terms of the policymakers, but really in terms of the interest groups, too, that work on the issues. There's just not a lot of crossover in transportation and air quality, which is a problem. We need to recognize the role that the built environment plays on energy use and greenhouse gas emissions. When people talk about the built environment, in these terms, they will talk about building efficiency, which is a very important thing. Buildings are responsible for a great deal of emissions. However, a lot of the policies we put in place to deal with more efficient buildings has resulted in new buildings being built that are very efficient, but moving buildings from the center of cities out to the exurbs and increasing transportation to that building by so much, we more than make up for all the benefits of the new building. You know, you see LEED certified buildings on green fields out in the middle of nowhere. My husband works with the FBI and used to be downtown, and I think we can all admit that the FBI building downtown is not so great. And there's a beautiful building that they build out in Tysons, but now, you know, whereas over 30% of the workforce used to take transit down to the FBI building, now every single person drives out to the building in Tysons because they don't even have transit outside of a very, very small window and really only about two shuttle buses in morning and afternoon from transit. So it makes it incredibly inconvenient. And federal policy prohibits the use of a shuttle from downtown out to the building for anything other than making meetings. You can't be for commuting. So building efficiency without location efficiency is not a successful strategy. And I get worked up about these things because I've seen us make these mistakes several times, and there's a fear that we could make it again. In 75, when folks realized we needed to reduce our oil consumption, we created fuel economy standards. And we were very effective. Sometimes we feel like we weren't because oil usage increased, but we did increase the fuel economy of our fleet by a great deal. The problem was we allowed vehicle miles traveled to increase wildly. It went up 132% between the fuel economy standards in the late 90s. Only 13% of that was due to population growth, according to USDOT. And GDP growth was only about 60% over that time. So, you know, whereas people say that it occurred because of population and economy, the numbers don't hold true. Last year, when gas prices shot up, we did see people change their behavior. We saw them buy more fuel-efficient cars, unfortunately just temporarily. They're now going back to the same gas guzzlers. And they shifted their ways of travel where they could. And we saw transit ridership just go through the roof. We saw people try to walk and bike. But in the majority of communities in this country, those aren't really very viable options. And so what we discovered was people reduced their oil consumption by lowering their quality of life. This is a very disturbing situation because it sets up a competition in most people's minds between reducing oil usage, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, doing what's right for our national security, for the environment, and on the other side, their personal economic well-being. And the sad thing about this is this doesn't have to be the case. We have designed their community so that they have no choice but to see that alternative. Another thing that it was a little frustrating is while the price of oil went up, we saw people talk about the fuel economy of cars, which is a good thing, though Congress had just increased CAFE the year before, and we've gone and sought a more aggressive increase in CAFE and tailpipe emissions through our most recent announcement on that. But a lot of the conversation centered around investment in alternative fuels, and what they meant by that was wind and solar, which is very helpful in a state like Hawaii, which uses a lot of oil for its energy production. But until we've electrified the fleet, doesn't really do much to lower gas prices for the average American. And electrification of the fleet is decades off at best. So the deal is we cannot succeed in reducing our oil usage and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector if we're not addressing the transportation system and how far and how long people have to drive. We can raise CAFE, which we have. We can improve the use of biofuels, which I think you'll see in the energy bill. But while that brings the emissions and the oil usage from the transportation sector down considerably, it does not bring us to our targets or really even near our targets. So that means we either attack the issue or give up the goal or transfer the responsibility for the ever-increasing emissions from the transportation sector to another sector, which is a ridiculous prospect. We can absolutely take care of this problem with transportation. It just requires a coordination between these policies and a focus on the issue. A lot of folks will say that if we do a climate change bill with an upstream cap, that we will address this problem. An upstream cap means increase people's gas prices. And the problem is that, one, if gas prices are where they are today and a cap and trade system raised them even by the largest numbers I've seen, which is not very high, it would not do much to change behavior because gas prices are inherently so low right now. The other thing is that transportation or that price signal is sent to the user, but the user is not in charge of the transportation options they have, and that price signal doesn't go to transportation planners. So it's a mismatch in terms of creating a market, and cap and trade is a great market-based program if you have a market, but in the transportation sector, most people don't have a market in order to choose which mode they travel by. People need safe, convenient alternatives to driving, and that requires a major capital investment in transit, sidewalks, the redesign of our streets to support walking and biking, as well as a concentration of development, infill development, mixed use, mixed income developments. Make sure that people are close to the things they want to do. They're close to school, they're close to work, they're close to the grocery, they're close to restaurants. I think of my mother, who does live very close to many of these things. So check box one. Box two is, can she get there on foot? Well, she could, but she'd have to play a real-life game of Frogger, for those of you all who remember Atari. And there, you do find some communities that have great sidewalks, though they tend to be disjointed, but they don't link to any place that anybody wants to go. So while they might be useful for taking a nice evening walk, they're certainly not a real transportation mode. To get better outcomes, we're going to have to address transportation in the climate change bill and climate change in the transportation bill. Now, one thing we should be considering is the fact that success in terms of reducing oil usage and reducing greenhouse gas emissions has a very negative impact on the funding we raise through the user fee for transportation. And that is true both in terms of a gas tax and a VMT tax. If people have the alternative to get on transit or ride their bike, they're not driving as far. And, of course, we don't want people to have to spend 2 hours in their car a day in order to do what they need to do. So, and the other thing is, historically, raising money from road users has not resulted in the transit investment that a lot of people would like to see. So looking for other sources of funds that don't come with the historical break might be a useful conversation to have. The administration's working on a lot of these issues. We're working on a reauthorization position as well as our reaction to the Waxman-Markey bill. I don't have a lot of answers yet about where we're going to come down on these issues. What I can point to are things we're already doing in transportation. People have heard a lot about the high-speed rail program and really just greater investment in intercity rail, period, which can do a lot to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and oil usage in intercity travel. We're also involved in a livability initiative with the Housing and Urban Development Department. We're looking to coordinate our programs to make sure the housing programs consider transportation. We're locating affordable housing close to transportation alternatives so that we're not locating people on property that might be inexpensive but requires them to increase their transportation so much that it comes out of wash. And transportation programs that look at the reverse, where we're putting transportation, what the impact is on household income, those sorts of things. HUD has a request into Congress for a new sustainability program to improve regional planning. And we're looking at ways to make sure that if they get funding for that, which we certainly hope they do, it is fused with what we do in transportation planning to make sure that there's, again, not a mismatch in programs. The goal is to coordinate local economic development planning decisions with housing, water, and transportation decisions and funding. We can do this in a way that lowers all our costs and comes out with better outcomes. Right now, a lot of the investment decisions we make in transportation push off costs onto other programs like the water programs and housing and onto local governments, and that need not be the case. We're also starting to see these issues, initial attempts to address these issues in Congress. The Waxman-Markey bill does address transportation planning. Unfortunately, right now it addresses it in a whole new transportation planning program handled by EPA. And since we're trying to break down stovepipes in general and look for greater efficiencies overall, creating an unfunded, totally separate planning program in EPA versus a pretty well-funded, even considering the situation of the Highway Trust Fund, at transportation might not be a great mesh for good success. In the transportation bill, we're expecting to see a bill in the House soon, but early indications are, even though they want to look for performance standards, which I think everybody agrees is a good thing, the initial reports are those performance standards would be set by states and cities separately. And again, if we're looking to coordinate policy and make sure federal dollars are spent well, we probably need to discuss what we expect to get from those dollars from D.C. So I can offer you almost no solutions today because we have no administration positions on these issues. But I can lay out all the problems and things we're trying to consider, and hopefully we'll be able to come back with our position on in the near future. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
We only have two simple rules on questions here, and those of you who have been here before, you understand what they are. It's when you're recognized, identify who you are, and to the extent you can, state your question in the form of a question. That would be real helpful. And why don't we go ahead? Mitzi, you want to start?
Oh, sure. I'm Mitzi Wertheim. I run something called the Energy Conversation, and the whole objective was to bring together as many departments and agencies to get them talking to one another to do exactly what you're proposing. My question is, I'm really excited about how you are bringing people in to think systemically mm-hmm. about these issues. My question is, how well is it going?
It's a good question. I've only been on the job for about 6 weeks so far, but we've already spent a very large amount of time together, and there is extreme excitement. And I think it's in a very productive way. There's been some encouragement from various sectors for us to form MOUs and formal agreements, which we have tried to stay away from. We feel like that's a way to spend a lot of time negotiating one piece of paper, but the second we change over personnel, we lose the MOU to a great extent. Our goal is to figure out what we need for our programs through our various reauthorizations, through our various funding requests, and then make sure this stuff gets ensconced in law and regulations so that it lasts. And we are going through these programs systematically right now to figure out what that would mean. It's a lot of upfront work, but we hope it will be very productive down the line. We have standing weekly meetings for our overall group. We're breaking out into working groups and meeting separately. There is a ton of work going on, and I hope that we can show something very tangible for folks in the very near future. I believe you had your hand up first.
I'm Bob Marley, and I work at the Department of Energy. I'm a senior career official there. And for the last many, many years, I've been working on something called the Climate Change Technology Program, which is an interagency thing. I've worked quite a bit with transportation, trying to get them to think big picture strategy on how to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. And I finally saw very encouraging signs of life in the last, say, 8 months, starting from today going back. So a little bit of bridging the transition. They're working on something called a comprehensive strategy for transportation. And one of the problems I've always seen in DOT is that you're so stovepiped on mm-hmm. highways and rails mm-hmm. and marine and freight and transit and RITA, et cetera, that you really needed somebody at the OST level to mm-hmm. kind of bring it together. And so I'm wondering, how's the strategy going? Is it really going to catch hold? And is the secretary now standing up to lead and coordinate that, which would be probably you?
There's some very, very positive signs initially. We'll start with the bad news first and head to the good news. The bad news is our program really doesn't support doing what you're saying. It's a very regimented, structured program. The funding flows by stovepipe, And as long as the funding flows by stovepipe, you are not going to get past it. It can't be done just by the mechanics of the program. Most recently, in the Recovery Act, Congress put together a discretionary grant program, actually with no earmarks, of $1.5 billion, and our solicitation for that went out on May 18th. It's been nicknamed Tiger Grants. I can't honestly tell you what that stands for. Transportation something. But it is the first discretionary multimodal pot that's going to be managed out of OST, and the goal is to do exactly what you're talking about. And frankly, we consider it kind of our audition to Congress. You know, look at how we can handle this so that you might consider that doing this on a more permanent basis is a good idea. Our applications are due on September 15th, and there's a lot of anticipation on what we're going to receive. You know, it's a Recovery Act program, and therefore the projects have to be close to completion in the next few years to really be competitive. So, and it has to be well distributed over rural and urban communities and across the country. So there are some restrictions. It's not purely competitive. And so it's going to be interesting to see what we get in and how many people have had innovative proposals kind of in the bag waiting for something like this. But we're very sensitive to what you're saying, and we're trying to figure out what that means for a long-term bill, and hopefully we'll have some proposals out in the very near future so that we can tell Congress what it is we're thinking before they get too far ahead.
With your counterparts dealing with the international aspects of climate and transportation, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Speaking of stovepipes, at DOT, even within the Undersecretary for Policy's office, there are two different offices. One is policy, which tends to be domestic and surface, and then the other one, which is aviation international affairs. And historically, these offices have operated almost completely separately. And we've gone out of our way to stop that, to really cross over and make sure we all feel like we're part of the same office, to start to look at what you're discussing. We particularly understand when it comes to aviation that most everything we do is going to be done on the international front, because clearly planes don't stay very well within borders. So hopefully that will increase. A lot of this with regards to greenhouse gas emissions, we are working with Congress to figure out the best way to do that. But from the Department of Transportation's perspective, we want to make sure that we are sensitive to the international processes that are in place. We feel like there's a lot of success we can have through that, and we want to make sure that that's reflected in whatever policy we put together. But the coordination has improved really dramatically already.
Itinerant consultant, could you comment on in the sense of coordination what went on to get NHTSA and EPA together on the CAFE standards and the tailpipe standards, and does that bode well for the future?
Yes, it really does. There are a couple things going on there. I don't think it's any secret that NHTSA and OAQPS have not had the greatest relationship over history. But this process was an incredible opportunity to break down some of those barriers. We spent a lot of time together. Our folks at NHTSA have worked unbelievably hard. And this is yet another example of a DOT program that is incredibly structured, incredibly dictatorial in how it will run, versus an EPA program that almost has no structure whatsoever. I mean, it was amazing in our conversations. Under the Clean Air Act, they could do almost anything they wanted to do. And then they'd look at us and we'd say, but the law requires us to do X, Y, and Z. So the coordination has been tricky. It's a joint rulemaking, and we have to make sure we comply with our separate and extremely different statutes. But the process we've gone through to get to where we are today, while some serious bumps in the road, has resulted in a much improved relationship, and I think a lot more trust than we had before. We're already looking at other tasks that we're going to have to work on together and looking for excuses to continue that relationship in every way possible to continue to improve it and make sure that that these programs are well coordinated. I do think it's a good example of what we can do when people really want to make those relationships work. And if we can make it work between the Energy Act and the Clean Air Act, there really isn't anything we can't coordinate.
I'm Dick Van Adam with the Science and Technology Policy Institute, and last week I spent a considerable amount of time at the Intelligent Transportation Systems Conference, which was a very long, stovepiped, so stovepiped I couldn't figure out which sessions to go to. But there was kind of an interesting set of things on the climate change way over here. Vehicle intelligent transportation over there, a little bit on public transit, very little, and no integration of them in any comprehensive or coordinated way. Part of the thing that struck me is I don't see within DOT, maybe there is some mechanism for strategically assessing the interrelationships between these in some sort of analytical way, region by region, area by area, providing support to the regions. San Francisco struck me as being particularly aware of the interdependencies and trying to build some planning capabilities. But I don't think there are any planning models and analytical tools to help do that. So where in DOT would that kind of strategic assessment, planning, and support come from, and how would you get that to support the regions when they're trying to do that?
You know, it's a really excellent question, and again, it comes down to the structure of our program does not lend itself to a lot of that. We do have some folks in our planning office at FHWA who are looking at best practices and trying to pull people together and let them know that what's out there and upgrade models, and that's very positive. But, you know, if you ask people what the transportation program is, they will say it's a federally funded, state-run program. Well, a federally funded, state-run program is not conducive to a federal bureaucracy that can provide the assistance you're talking about. So we need to look at this in a reauthorization, look at the structure of our program in DOT and what our role is with regard to technical assistance and research and modeling pushing technology out and those sorts of things. This has not been traditionally seen as the role of DOT. And certainly, with some policy changes, we could be a lot better in those respects.
Thank you. My name is Shirley Neff. I'm a fellow here at CSIS. I'm also a member of the Federal Biomass Technical R&D Advisory Committee, and I drive a flex fuel vehicle. So my question is going to be about E85 and where we're headed with the biofuels program. As you know, there's a federal mandate in place that steps up the amount of biofuels that have to be absorbed in the market. It's a national program. I actually worked for the Senate when this was being developed, and at that point, a lot of us thought it didn't make sense to have it a national program given the concentration of production. Nonetheless, here we are. Now, with what's happened with the auto manufacturers, GM, which was the only company that made a real commitment to producing flex fuel vehicles, it's not clear how much they're going to do. As far as I know, there's no mandate or even consideration of requiring manufacturers to start making most vehicles flex fuel. There are a number of people here in this room who've been dealing with this issue as long as I have, and we see this sort of disconnect in public policy, and within a few years, I mean, this is leading to redundant infrastructure, potentially infrastructure that'll be abandoned soon because there won't be enough ethanol to serve certain markets. Are you really discussing this? Is this a priority for the administration at this point in time?
I was on the Hill when this was developed as well, and remember the discussions about whether or not a national policy had the chance to work. It has been difficult and frustrating. In the tailpipe emissions standard, CAFE standard, we have continued to include the flex fuel vehicle credit, which we think will help with that. It's very interesting what some of the ramifications of this program can be, whereas all three of the domestic automakers have made a commitment to build flex fuel vehicles, though GM to the greatest extent. Most of the flex fuel vehicles they tend to build are 6 and 8 cylinder engines. And a lot of these mandates we put very heavily fall on the federal government. The department with the largest domestic fleet, civilian fleet, is the post office, which gets better fuel economy and uses less oil by driving 4-cylinder engines. So we have to figure that out. There's actually a fix that was put in place for that issue, but you know, flex fuel cars on their own is not a good enough goal. It has to be flex fuel on every type of car, encouraging people to upsize in order to use a flexible fuel just does not get us where we're going. So it continues to be an extremely complex issue. You're right. There's a focus on other technologies as well, and there seems to be a large movement of people that want to see us just simply electrify the fleet, which may be a wonderful goal, but again, decades away. So I think people are trying to grapple with an extremely complex issue and try to figure out how this fits in with the rest of the goals. And I don't know that we have answers right now. I probably have time for we'll do 2 more questions.
Ken Austin, Treasury Department. The title of this conference is Energy Security, Climate Change, and Transportation. We talked about stovepiping. But one of the things that I've noticed is that stovepiping, if people are interested in climate change, can be almost contemptuous of the need to provide adequate and secure supply of liquid fuels, which, as you pointed out, isn't going away anytime soon.
Nope.
Is there anything that you see, any movement toward actually recognizing the fact that we are dependent on imported transportation fuels and we're going to need to address that issue before we abolish transportation fuels?
It's an excellent question, and I would even back up and take it from 20,000 feet. A lot of people just don't want to deal with mobile sources at all. I've actually heard people, especially economists, say it's just hard. And it is. There are too many inputs. As far as creating a tight market cap, when you've got inputs from the fuels and from the user and how they travel and from the way the community's designed and the transportation options provided and the types of cars, and I mean, there's so many different points of contact. There's not one place to leverage to shift these issues like you have with stationary sources. You also just have so many different tailpipes that it's extremely difficult to control. I really would like to see people step back, admit that we're not going to fix this overnight, admit that we could make a big impact quickly, though, and start looking at all 3 legs of the stool. How do you deal in the short run with making a market for biofuels or for alternative fuels? How do we create a good market for fuel-efficient vehicles? How do we allow people to drive less in the first place? You know, how do we convince people that a sidewalk is as sexy as a hybrid car?
But how do you convince people that you're going to have to produce liquid fuel even if they're not zero emission?
You know, I think that people, if they felt like we were on course to a good solution, would be at rest with that. The discomfort is people are uncomfortable going into the issue of the transportation sector, period. And when they get there, they discover there's not one quick answer like, we'll just raise CAFE standards and fix everything, which is what people want it to be. And then when they get there and they look at all the solutions, they recognize that it's a hodgepodge and it's difficult and they have to coordinate, and even then, it's not going to get fixed overnight. And that's a very disconcerting place to be, particularly for policymakers that want to be able to explain very quickly how they're going to make things better. And so we need smart people helping us figure out all those individual pieces and then helping us frame how they all go together to make progress, recognizing that this isn't getting fixed in the next 5-10 years. So, but I think having solutions makes people more comfortable with that reality. So,
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. You talked about a lot of issues that have trade-offs. What kinds of technologies are you looking at which will improve the situation within these trade-offs?
That's a big question. You know, within the transportation system, there's a lot we can do in technology with ITS, which was raised, just better operation of the system we already have. There's a lot of conversation about technologies that can go into vehicles that can help with better communication between them and therefore better operations, but also in terms of shifting us over from a gas tax to a VMT tax, which is not the sexiest way to sell the technology. While people really want to jump into technology, and we discuss technology a ton with regard to the tailpipe emission standard and CAFE and safety and those sorts of issues, what we're talking about in terms of VMT isn't really a technology. It's things like inclusionary zoning, and you know, which again, it will make most people start to snore to hear, but it has such an enormous impact on how people get around. There are some technologies we can do to help with the planning to make it better in terms of better modeling, in terms of being able to overlay different impacts of separate transportation and land use decisions, which will have remarkable impacts on quality of life, oil usage, climate change, air pollution, water pollution, affordability issues. You can go on and on and on. But you do need some good technologies and planning tools to allow people to compare what different things do to all of these various factors. I think of what Envision Utah did in Salt Lake City in the Wasatch Valley. And they had four different proposals that looked at land use and housing and job and economic development and transportation decisions. You know, A being kind of business as usual, B being a little more transit heavy, and C being a lot more infill development, transit heavy, and then D being the ultimate smart growth solution. And they found very interesting things out that surprised people. C, even though it wasn't the most compact, the most smart growth, the most transit, performed better than D, because in the valley, when you had development too compact, you increased air pollution because it got trapped. You actually increased infrastructure costs because you were having to take care of so many people in a small area. And these are things you can't really compare until you have the planning tools available to you to make these, you know, somewhat boring-sounding zoning and development decisions. So, you know, we can talk about vehicle technologies, we can talk about operational technologies, but we do need to talk about these models and planning technologies, not just in terms of helping policymakers make the right decision, but helping them communicate what those decisions mean to the public. Because one thing Envision Utah did really, really well was get huge public buy-in by being able to explain in a very graphic and tangible way that people got to interact with what these decisions would mean. And so when a decision was made, people really bought into that decision. Yeah, envisionutah.org, I believe. It really is the coolest program. And I have a bias. I have a rule in my office that no one brings up Portland. No offense to Portland, but we've heard about it. We need to hear about somebody else doing those cool things. And Utah really has an incredible program that honestly started by extreme buy-in at each local government level. It was actually an outside group that came in and brought all those local governments in little by little. But there's some lessons there that could be applied really almost anywhere in the country, and would love to see that repeated. So.
Beth, I would tell you, I'm not only comforted by the fact that your substantive grasp of the issues is most impressive, but the blend of enthusiasm and pragmatism that it's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
This doesn't happen overnight. Appreciate your candor. Very much appreciate you coming. We may have you back if that works into your schedule. If you'll
join
me.
Maybe if you do, I'll have something to say about the administration's position. Wouldn't that be exciting?
No, you got time for that. Join me in thanking Beth Osborne.
Thank you all.
Love to have you. While we're setting up for the slide presentation, I'd like to ask the first panel to come up so we can get seated, and then we'll be able to seamlessly transition. Thank you.
If you could all take your seats so we can get started. All right, so after Beth's remarks this morning, the idea of transportation and climate change and energy security is an issue that's not new to any of you. It's certainly not new to us at the center here. For the last several years, we've been working at various facets of this. 2005 to 2007, actually with Darren and Jim and others in this room, we worked on the National Petroleum Council study, which looked at energy technologies and sought to find trade-offs between energy security, climate change, and economic viability. In 2007 and 2008, with the help of Dr. Doug Arendt here of NREL, we had a series of sessions on transportation fuels, looking at technology, looking at vehicles, looking at infrastructure, and behavioral policies. And we expect to have that report released by the end of July, so we'll make that available. And then most recently, in 2008 and beginning of 2009, and several of you were here for that, we produced a roadmap transitioning to a low-carbon economy that we did with the World Resources Institute, and one of our co-authors there was Jonathan Pershing. And Jonathan, as you know, is now the Deputy Director of Climate Change over at the State Department and the Climate Negotiator. So this is an issue that we've taken a look at from a variety of different sides. We found a lot of the things that Beth has found, that there's no simple solutions, that it requires trade-off. It's huge amounts of investments. We're relying on technology. It requires behavioral change, and it requires decades to make the transformation. So with that lead-in, let me just do a little stage setting here. Transforming the transportation sector. So transformation is not new to the American economy. In the last 150 years, we've had at least two transformations. We went between 1850 or 1750 and 1810. We went from about 75% renewable energy to 80% coal as we worked our way through the Industrial Revolution. Between 1910 and 1970, we went from 80% coal to 65% oil and gas. And in large part, that was due because of transportation, building of the highway system, and the automobile. When you start looking forward, and several years ago we talked about peak oil, and it was always our sense on the peak oil debate that it was more above ground than below ground, that the resource endowment, when you looked at it as molecules in the ground, it was indeed enormous. But when you looked at not the geology, but the geography, the concentration, the geopolitics, the investment, the security, the transport, the environmental issues, it's not a sustainable future. So a third transformation has to take place, but it's going to be done over a longer time frame. Our transportation needs account for 2/3 of U.S. petroleum consumption and 97% of our transport needs ground, air, and rail, also marine transport, are performed with petroleum. So when you look at supply sources and you look at the end transition, even before you get to electrification, you need to consider various pathways, and I know Doug will talk a little bit about that, but it also requires investment, and it requires you to be a little bit more forward-looking. So we've always thought it's time to reset the system. You want to look at a future that's a lower carbon economy, certainly, but managing that transition over decades is going to be extremely important. So the current situation in the United States, and Beth touched on this, but the average person drives more than 12,000 miles a year. Since 1970, we had slightly different data that we were looking at, but VMT increased almost 4.5 times the rate of population growth. It was 173% increase in miles traveled, while the population grew at about 47%. By 2050, if you look at the forecast for the economy, and an economy that's 3.5 to 4 times larger than today, we expect transportation needs and energy for transportation to increase by a factor of 2 to 2.5. Transport costs represent slightly less than 20% of the average household's income, and it could be up to 30% for low-income households. So we also have equity issues and social issues we have to deal with. And the American Society of Civil Engineers, in their January report card, which they rated transportation infrastructure at a D, talks about a funding gap. So what we're actually spending, what they project that we will actually need. And the IEA has similar forecasts globally. This is not just a U.S. problem. When you look at vehicle transportation throughout the world and you look at population growth, GDP, and standards of living in China and India especially, this is a problem that's going to have to be solved on a global basis. And when you add the component of climate change, it makes it that much more difficult. This is the non-electric fuel pathways chart. We didn't put electricity in because it's confusing enough to start with at this point. This is in our alternative fuels report. I don't want to steal Doug's thunder again on this point, but it just shows you the options that you need to pursue, a variety of remedies, all of which takes time, all of which will not be successful. And then finally, the end goal is to have a transportation service that's affordable, reliable and secure, and environmentally friendly. So what that means is that we can't harm the economy because we have to continue economic growth. The fuels have to be available when we need them. And we have to limit, as far as we can, the adverse impacts on the environment. So we've been talking about this for a great deal of time. I suspect we'll have more conversations in the future. There's been an enormous amount of study. And as Beth indicated, the new administration is just at the formative stages of looking at climate change, keeping the economy going, how to pursue energy technologies while we keep the conventional system robust, because that's what we're going to need to transition through that period. And with that framing, I will introduce to you Doug Arendt. Doug is the Director of Strategic Analysis at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, but he's also an affiliate of us here at CSIS. And I will turn the podium over to him for the first panel discussion. Thanks very much. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you, Frank.
Let's see, mics to manipulate slides.
Yep.
Okay. Morning, everyone. Pleasure. Thank you, Frank, thanks CSIS for hosting and pulling this together. I have just a couple of comments. Having spent now many years looking at alt transportation, both fuels as well as vehicle technologies, et cetera, and I think I want to reflect on the first one, which is really related to Beth's comment this morning, which is while Frank put up the non-electricity fuels pathway chart that I think lays out a number of different technology options, I think we have to challenge ourselves very carefully and even throughout the next panel to think about transportation services. And that's going to be a bit of a stretch because we're all focused on technologies and technology solutions rather than what really is the service provision provided going forward. The second piece which I would prompt us to think about as we listen through and create some questions for the next set of speakers is really what is mindful analysis that is needed. I think one of the key messages Beth brought up is that it's a very complicated sector. There are many, many different players, many different technologies, many different service options, and many different policies. And the questions really at hand are, how do we get our handle on this complexity? And perhaps, how might we propose to simplify it? And the third really relates to Frank's comment, and as well as to Beth's, which is, I would call it patience but persistence. Transforming an enormously large infrastructure and sector will take time, but without a vision in front of us and a collective will to make that vision a reality, we will be very, very challenged to get to speed and to scale to make that transformation work forward. So in order to address those three elements as well as the issues that Frank brought up, we have three very talented speakers, very knowledgeable as well. I think we're going to go down as they're presented in your packet. I'm not going to read the bios, so let us first welcome Anoop Bandivadikar. Did I do well? It's okay. The passenger vehicle program lead at the International Council on Clean Transportation, and he gets the prize for flying the furthest to be here today, having just flown in from India, I believe, yesterday. I came from Colorado. So please welcome him and give him a very large round of applause for making that trip. Apologies if I have to do a quick you want to pull it up?
Yeah, all right. I can pull it up. Good morning, everybody. My name is Anoop Bandivadikar, and I'm the passenger vehicle lead at the International Council on Clean Transportation. And thanks, Doug, for the introduction. I was in India just for a week, by the way, so I'm normally based in Washington, D.C., so I needed to get back here anyway. But some very exciting things happening in India about vehicle fuel economy, but that's for another time. Let me just give you a short take about the International Council on Clean Transportation. It's a relatively new organization, so a lot of you may be unfamiliar with us. As the name suggests, we are international in nature, hence the trip to India. We are composed of a council of regulators and experts from around the world who are focused on transportation, air pollution, and greenhouse gas emissions around the world. And by around the world, we mainly mean the top 10 vehicle markets of the world that we list here. The passenger vehicle program that I am a part of is right now active in six of those areas, China, India, Brazil, Mexico, are our primary work. We are launching a very substantial program in Europe right now, along with our continuous work here with the folks at the EPA and California on the U.S. issues. But for today, Sarah asked me to really speak about some of the work I had done previously at MIT in a report we titled On the Road in 2035 with a host of my colleagues. And the report and all of its details are available on the web for those who need to get it. And it's a good way to sort of get into this discussion because I will focus a little bit more about on the vehicle technology and say why some of the things that Beth talked about in the morning make more sense, even if you look at the vehicle technology in a very careful manner, is what are the other things that are required to get on with it. On the Road in 2035, as the name suggests, we really focused on evaluating the vehicle technology and the fuels that go with it some 25 years out into the future. And the approach really was to do engineering simulations to try to extract out from the vehicle technology perspective how much of a fuel consumption reduction is possible, how much of greenhouse gas emission reduction is possible through means of vehicle and fuel technology. But then we wanted to go a bit further and say, okay, how far do these technologies penetrate into the marketplace? Because that's a real question, and I'll get to some of that later on. Just by the way of setting up, we're talking about a very complicated technology framework right now, and this is a really exciting time to be working on automotive technology because really for the first time, I would say in 75, 80 years, that the dominance of the internal combustion engine-driven vehicles has been challenged. Not to say that the internal combustion engine technology hasn't changed. In fact, it has changed dramatically over this time period. It's become way more efficient over the time frame. But the introduction of hybrid electric vehicles and sort of the round-the-corner introduction of plug-in hybrid vehicles and electric and fuel cell vehicles is really the first time when we have a whole suite of technologies that are trying to penetrate into the marketplace. And the pathways that they take are going to be rather different. And the first pathway on the left is the ICE, the internal combustion engine-based pathway, which is really improving in an incremental basis. And what makes life difficult for the technologies on the right-hand side is that that baseline isn't static. That it's always tempting for advocates of a new technology to compare today's gasoline or a diesel vehicle with tomorrow's plug-in hybrid car. The fact remains that the incumbent technology keeps on improving and has done it so at a very impressive rate and will keep on doing so for the next 25 years, at least the time frame in which we looked. So that's a very important perspective to keep in mind. Secondly, what's happening on the SI, the spark ignition, the gasoline engines, and the CI, the compression ignition diesel engines, they're sort of becoming more and more like one another. They're trying to take out the features that are best from one another. So the gasoline engines are trying to take the higher compression ratios of the diesel that inherently gives it higher efficiency. The diesel engines are trying to mimic some of the features of the gasoline engines that try to reduce emissions while retaining its advantage in terms of fuel consumption reductions. The second pathway is really the one in the middle, which is where we are currently, is the hybrid electric vehicles, which sort of have a downsized, a smaller engine, and a battery pack and a motor combination that sort of gives you additional sources of reducing fuel consumption. And that's important because it gives you opportunities that were not previously feasible on an internal combustion engine alone. The next step of that, which is currently, I would say, the latest flavor in the town, is the plug-in hybrid vehicles, which everybody apparently is now in love with, which is a pathway, really, to get to the next sort of the promise of technologies, the electric car at some point of time. And, of course, the third pathway was the flavor 5 years ago. That's the fuel cell-based pathway. Is everybody was all rage about hydrogen fuel cell vehicles and what they can do some time ago. And, of course, they are a promising long-term pathway. Initially, all of them will, of course, be hybridized because you'll have a big battery and motor combination along with a hydrogen fuel cell stack to propel it forward. Maybe sometime into the real distant future, we'll have just a fuel cell-operated vehicle. But that's the landscape of technology that we are seeing, and there is a time axis to it that we have to grapple with as we look at where the transportation, energy, and climate issues are headed. So I'll just sort of explain in a short what are the results in terms of technology assessment for looking out 25 years ahead. And the axes on these are the two things we care about. We care about how much petroleum we consume. That's the energy security side of things. But then we also care about what are the greenhouse gas emissions. That's the other axis, the x-axis on the scale. And really, you want to be on the lower left-hand corner, that your petroleum consumption measured here in liters per 100 kilometers or gallons per 100 miles, whatever way you measure, you want to be that as low as possible, while you want your greenhouse gas emissions to be very low. Now, around today's technology, our baseline was a 2005 Camry-type vehicle. It's not even on this chart. Its petroleum consumption is around 8.8 liters per 100 kilometers, and greenhouse gas emissions are 250. So that's way out somewhere in the top right-hand corner of the chart above the scale. And these are the vehicles and the fuel combination roughly 25 to 30 years ahead and how much potential they have in terms of reducing emissions. So you really have your mainstream spark ignition gasoline technology that can improve by something like 25 to 30%. But then, of course, it depends on what fuel you put into that tank. That'll challenge its emissions and actual petroleum consumption. So, of course, adding more oil sands from Canada, while good from energy security perspective, will, of course, raise the emissions by roughly 10 to 15% on that improved vehicle. Ethanol, sort of the E10 type ethanol from corn or even a cellulosic will get you down only a little bit more on top of that. So not a whole lot of more compared to what you gain in terms of vehicle technology. The ones that are likely to come into the market really quickly in the U.S. are the turbocharged gasoline engines and what we call direct injection turbocharged engines. They get you much more beyond what the internal combustion engine gasoline can do and really take you very close to where the diesels can be. And so there's always that question about, is the U.S. market going to go the diesel way like the European market has gone? And it's a real difficult question, but when you consider what you can achieve by modifying the gasoline turbocharged engine, and you look at all the emissions after treatment problem with diesels that you have to face and the cost that you incur, really the benefits of dieselizing in the U.S. may not be as large as one might think. But really what stands out from this magenta and red dots is that blue dot here down, the gasoline hybrid vehicle. And you notice that it really separates itself from that pack of internal combustion engine technologies, that it really increases the gap. Right now, today's hybrid vehicles are around 25, 30% more efficient compared to the gasoline, normal gasoline-driven vehicles. Our projection is that that gap is likely to increase, not decrease. As we have really begun now to understand how to integrate the battery motor combination with the vehicle internal combustion engine. And as hybrid technology evolves, it'll give us more and more opportunities to keep the internal combustion engine operating at its most efficient regions and then using the electric drive for much of the rest of the part, which helps you drive down the hybrid emissions. What's more important is that the latest development in battery technologies, the most advanced lithium-ion battery packs that are coming into the market now, they're all very high power density battery packs, which means that the batteries on tomorrow's hybrids are going to be smaller, they're going to weigh less, they're going to cost a lot less. That means the cost differential between today's petrol, the gasoline engine, and the hybrid engine is going to be much smaller tomorrow. Now, below that, you have kind of the current sort of everybody's interest in the plug-in hybrid. And, of course, what if your goal is to reduce petroleum consumption, then that is really the technology pathway that is most promising right now, is that it halves, almost halves the petroleum consumption from hybrid electric vehicles. But if you notice the greenhouse gas emissions from it, they're not that different. Well, if your grid is a little bit cleaner, if you have all natural gas grid, then it'll be a little bit better than gasoline. If it's all coal, it's a little bit worse. On an average, it's about the same into the future. So you really need something else to happen in the grid to make a big difference, to give that push over and above a hybrid technology. And the choice for policies really is that additional cost of investing from a hybrid vehicle to a plug-in hybrid vehicle pay off. It may or may not have that big greenhouse gas emission reduction, but it has petroleum reduction, and how much we value that as opposed to just getting greenhouse gas emissions. And, of course, you have a whole slate of electric vehicles and fuel cell vehicles, which obviously have a big advantage of not having any petroleum consumption. So, again, a step towards petroleum security. But in terms of their overall greenhouse gas emissions, not that different from where you would find with tomorrow's hybrids and plug-in hybrids. So that's the landscape in terms of technology. And so a couple of my colleagues and I, what we try to do is to project that forward to 2050 on a fleet-wide basis and see how it looks. If our target is really two things, is sort of a more or less simplistically, we said, oh, we want to completely do away with petroleum imports. So we want the U.S. petroleum to take care of all the transportation demand. And at the same time, we want to try to meet the more stringent climate targets that are being proposed, sort of something like an 80% reduction from the 1990 levels of emissions. And these are passenger vehicle numbers only, but you can do a similar thing for heavy-duty vehicles and other sources. And the chart sort of takes you back in time, sort of shows that blip and then sort of going down after the CAFE in the 70s, and then the baseline is just assuming, you know, no changes happen, but obviously changes are already happening. But what you find in our sort of evolutionary pathway that doesn't take into account any electric or fuel cell vehicles and a modest penetration of plug-in hybrids, about a quarter of new vehicle sales by 2050, and about half hybrids, so roughly 75% are either hybrids or plug-in hybrids, equivalent to something like 60 miles per gallon. That gives you a big chunk of petroleum reductions. On top of that, even if you sort of went along with the current proposed renewable fuel standard, or something equivalent in a low-carbon fuel standard, whichever pathway we choose to go ahead into the future, about a 35, 37 billion gallons, which is kind of the current trajectory of the policy, it takes you down a little bit further. But then, of course, those two by themselves are sufficient, actually, to reduce petroleum imports. Now, if your goal is to go down to greenhouse gas emissions, you do need to have the third piece, the third leg of the stool in terms of what is the demand for transportation. And in this scenario, it's roughly about a 10% reduction in VMT. Unfortunately, that is not enough for us to get down to our greenhouse gas emissions targets. So I'll show you the second chart sort of assumes a more aggressive penetration. About a 50% penetration of new vehicle sales come from plug-in hybrids, about 25% from hybrids by 2050. So you are about 75 miles per gallon equivalent on all vehicles being sold into the marketplace. You add on top of that the biofuels. You reduce the greenhouse gas emissions intensity of the grid from around 200, 210 grams of CO2 per megajoule down to 40. You get additional piece of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. You additionally reduce the weight of the vehicles. Our baseline scenario assumes around 20% lighter, lightweight vehicles. You force it down to about 35% in terms of vehicle weight reduction. On top of that, now something that anybody would consider very aggressive, about a 30% reduction in VMT overall in all of these trends. And I already see some people going crazy. And yet, doing all of that, we don't get down to our target of 80% below 1990. And you say, okay, we'll cheat. We'll go 80% below 2005. The answer is no, you still don't get it to 80% below 2005. So if that is the stringency of the long-term policy we are looking at, just consider that this is what we consider a fairly aggressive projection forward on vehicle technology, on fuels, on electric grid, on VMT. And it's still, we fall a little bit short. But, I mean, we get quite a ways down. A couple of observations to follow that, and then I'll close. The current U.S. policy, I mean, we had a question about how the whole CAFE and greenhouse gas emission standards are going to work. And this chart shows our ICCTs. We keep on an ongoing basis a stock of where the vehicle fuel economy / greenhouse gas emission standards are around the world. And this chart shows you in sort of grams of CO2 per kilometer converted, sort of they are all, so that they are all equivalent to one another. And what the U.S. policy is showing is from where we are right now, going down over the next 7 or 8 years, down to the same level that California was proposing for 2016. That's the first step of this long way forward. Now, if you go back and say, okay, the 75 miles per gallon, where does that get you? 75 miles per gallon gasoline equivalent, that is going to require you to be somewhere close to 80 grams of CO2 per kilometer. So the current 2016 policy is proposing, if on a European equivalent level, 172, it's 155 on the U.S. cycle. But so you still need to get down from around 172 something in 2016 down to well below 80, more like 70 to 75 grams per kilometer on a CO2 basis. That's more than a doubling of fuel economy above whatever level we are talking. The targets in the European Union, which they have already agreed for a 2015 standard of around 130 grams per kilometer, and they're proposing, the discussions are on the table for a 95 grams per kilometer by 2020. That's roughly around 65 miles per gallon target by 2020. It's a very ambitious, very, and we don't know whether they would quite agree to that at the end. But the point of that is, while it's a huge step forward, the current U.S. policy is going to make a big difference, and it's actually going to push vehicle technology in a big way. It's a lot of work, and it's our only first step forward going forward. If we really are serious about eliminating petroleum imports and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The second part of that is the time scale matters. And the time scale, my personal take on it is we are almost often too optimistic in the short term and too pessimistic in the long term. Is all of a sudden we think we could snap our fingers and have these millions and millions of plug-in hybrids and electric cars and fuel cell cars running on the road, and we'll have lots of flex fuel vehicles and we'll have lots of fuel to go with it in a short period of time. And technology doesn't really work that way. While we know that we can get down to the levels that we need to get down whether it's 75 miles per gallon vehicles. The time frame for doing that is around 20, 25 years. You can push that very hard through policy. And that's why it's really important for policy to engage. Without that, it won't happen. But the policy also needs to consider by which time frame you can really get to these levels. And what I want to show is really a chart. I'm not sure it's going to look here very well. And that's so the chart shows monthly hybrid sales for the U.S. market. On the top chart, these are sort of the monthly numbers. The U.S. gasoline price, this is the weekly gasoline price, the regular grade gasoline. And then below that, you have sort of the people in the U.S. searching for the term hybrid in general. And I found it very remarkable. And this is for January of 2004 until May of 2009. And these trends line up pretty remarkably. I haven't done statistical analysis on this, but any casual observer can see a fairly good relationship between the three. Is consumers are indeed driven by anticipation of where fuel prices are going. They start looking for these hybrid terms on the web, and some of them even go out and buy a few. But then, of course, as the expectation of fuel prices is going down, the interest in looking for that technology and going there goes away. Why is that important? For many reasons. One is it shows hybrid vehicles or an advanced technology that is really, really cool is not immune to what happens in the rest of the market. So you see hybrid sales drop down. Secondly, we now have hybrid cars on the market for 10 years. The first Honda Insight came around 98, 99. First Prius came around 99, 2000. As of last month, the hybrid vehicles are around 2.5% of the new vehicle sales. They're roughly about 1+ million out of a 230 million light-duty vehicle fleet. And that's taken us 10 years with some really exceptional quality vehicles to get there. It's going to take us a long, long time for other technologies to do something similar. What is required is really we need to push it quite hard, but then to sort of assume that a technology A or technology B is going to take care of our problems, if we just push on it hard enough, it's not going to work. So some core principles and frameworks that we need to keep in mind as we move forward is really, from the charts previously, is that vehicle technology is probably indeed the most important piece of this puzzle. It doesn't get you all the way. You need the fuels part. You need to work on VMT issues. And all of them together will perhaps get us close to where we need to get. That's important. Secondly, is relying on technology A or B and playing the favorites is not going to work. We have a multitude of technologies, and right now we are pretty sure about what they can do in terms of emission reductions. We are not yet in a position to comfortably project the winning technology. And for policy to put our really scarce resources into promoting one technology, which was fuel cells 5 years ago, ethanol 3 years ago, maybe something else now, is really not consistent with the long-term time frame that we need to keep in mind if we are serious about addressing the problem. It's going to require standards, whether it's greenhouse gas emission standards from EPA or fuel economy from DOT, whether your fuel policy comes in terms of renewable fuel standards or low carbon fuel standards, whether your VMT policies comes as a fuel tax or pay as you drive or something else. But it's going to take us all of that effort. So with that, I'll just stop.
Thank you very much. It's a great setting. Actually, I'm going to ask for you to please jot your questions down. We're going to have an extended Q&A session at the end. I saw Bobby. We can bring them back up. Sure, we'll be happy to do that. I believe our next speaker is Jim Burkhardt, who's the Managing Director of the Global Oil Group at Cambridge Energy Research Associates. And, Jim, you have one slide, I believe. And so he's going to entertain us with that and a lot of good thinking. Do you know where it is?
I think it's on the desktop. Yes. Okay. You don't have to get it up right now. And call
you sure?
It up.
Okay.
You just put the desktop on. Yeah, that's perfect.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for the introduction, Doug, and thanks to CSIS and Sarah and Frank for the opportunity to speak to you all this morning. Two things I'm going to talk about. One, peak oil and how peak oil has arrived. And two, I'm going to share an idea about how the low-cost electric car, especially in Asia, could be a long-term game changer. But first, peak oil. Peak oil has arrived. We at CERA do believe peak oil has arrived. Some of you who are familiar with CERA's work may find that surprising, but not at all. Now, let me clear up some confusion. You may be thinking I'm talking about peak oil on the supply side. Peak oil, the thought that we've reached a geological point where we've produced more than half the world's oil. And we could have a day-long debate on that particular perspective on peak oil, but the peak oil I'm talking about is peak oil in transport fuel demand for the light-duty vehicles. Light-duty vehicle peak oil demand in the United States and Europe. We've reached it. We've reached peak oil in terms of light-duty vehicle transport demand for liquid fuels in the United States and Europe. This has peaked, we believe, in 2007. Roughly. In fact, my colleague Samantha Gross, who's in the room with me, she co-authored the report that we put out a year or so ago that set out this vision of U.S. gasoline demand having peaked. And that report came out before the depths of the Great Recession. So many of the forces that we see in play have been intensified by what's happened in the last year because of the economic slowdown, but doesn't change the overall course. Why do we expect peak oil for petroleum gasoline? I'm talking about petroleum gasoline. Why has that peaked in the United States? One, the biofuel mandates. Two, the lower growth in VMT, vehicle miles traveled. Since 2005, it's been flat. In 2008, we saw VMT decline. So far this year, vehicle miles traveled in the United States also declining. This is a trend that we haven't seen in many, many years, and it happened before the depths of the recession. We saw the VMT start to slow down in 2005, so it wasn't just since September 15th, 2008. Another factor is the fuel economy legislation. That's having a real impact. Again, it takes time for this to filter through. Newt mentioned the point that we don't change our transportation paradigm overnight, and we certainly don't expect that. But the fuel economy legislation in the United States will have a long impact. Will have a big impact in the long term. I know many of you in this room have played a role. Robbie Diamond's group at SAFE has played a role in informing the lawmakers about what we could achieve if there are greater fuel economy standards, and we will see that impact. And lastly, the Great Recession is intensifying these trends. Now, we hope that this is a temporary influence because having a severe recession leading to lower economic activity is not a good way to get to peak demand, but it is nonetheless pushing down on demand relative to where it was. Now, here's our picture of demand in the U.S., up at the top. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Okay. This is our outlook at CERA for gasoline demand growth in the United States out to 2030. And you see the yellow area, that's petroleum-based gasoline. And you see the peak in roughly 2007. We go down pretty low right now because of the Great Recession. It picks up a little bit, but we never get back up to that peak in 2007. And this is not due to some great new transportation paradigm falling down from the sky. Not at all. This is due to the factors that are already in place. There are some trends that could deviate, that could lead us to deviate from this outlook a bit. But generally speaking, we see this trend in place. You see there is a role for diesel, but we think diesel in the United States as opposed to Europe will be more of a niche transportation fuel for light-duty vehicles in the United States. So why does this matter? Why do we care about this? One, this is just a good reminder that things have happened and are happening that are reducing the long-term demand pressure on petroleum-based gasoline in the United States. And this matters because U.S. gasoline consumption, as many of you in the room know, U.S. gasoline consumption is pretty big. The U.S. consumes more gasoline than all of China does for oil demand. We spend a lot of time looking at demand trends in China, and they're very important. But the U.S. gasoline market is roughly 9 million barrels per day, even with the downturn. And the Chinese total oil market today is around 7.5 or so million barrels per day. About 1.4 million barrels per day of that is gasoline. So if you get a big change in this market, in the gasoline market, bigger than any other single national oil market in the world, you can have an impact on the global oil market. The same thing's happening in Europe. We believe that in Europe, liquid fuel demand for the light-duty vehicle fleet is flat to declining as well long-term. And the European oil market is also very large. If you look at Europe as a whole, oil demand there is about 15 million barrels per day, about 2.5 million barrels per day of gasoline, and 6.5 for distillate. And that distillate number includes other things besides diesel. But nonetheless, we're looking at the two very large oil markets in the world where demand for liquid fuels for the light-duty fleet is in decline. So what does this mean? What's the bigger picture here? One, in the last few years, we've always heard so much about the demand pull in China and India and elsewhere, the Middle East, for example, and that's real. People in those regions do want the same living standards, the life expectancy, the lower infant mortality that we have in the United States and Europe. And with that, they want more mobility. Well, to get all those things, you require more energy. And so that, I'm not denying the demand pull from those other areas, but this long-term downward trend in the U.S. and Europe, at least for light-duty transport fuels, is likely to lead to a lower rate of total oil demand growth over the next decade or two. We've seen after each oil shock, going back to 73, 74, it often leads to, more often than not, it often leads to a slower pace of total oil demand growth because a price shock institutes change in technology and behavior and policy that leads to a more gentle upward slope on oil demand. And we expect that to be the case over the next few years. It also means we could see large volumes of spare production capacity on both the upstream crude oil production side and also in the refining side. Today we have about 6.5 million barrels per day of spare crude oil production capacity. We've seen a decoupling of fundamentals from the oil price in recent months, at least that's our view. So we do have this large amount of spare capacity, whereas in recent years we had around 2 to 3 million barrels per day of spare production capacity. So we have a heck of a lot more. With demand in a slump, we could see the spare capacity hang around for a while. On the refining side, it's not a particularly advantageous time to be in the refining business. This year, global oil demand is going to fall by, we believe, 2.2 million barrels per day, biggest decline in a generation. And it just so happens that this year, we're also going to see the biggest increase in global crude oil distillation capacity. That's refining capacity. To see the biggest increase in refining capacity the very time that we're seeing such a massive downturn in demand. So it's creating, at least in some quarters, not all, certainly not in the NYMEX crude oil market, it's creating concern in some quarters that we could see large volumes of spare capacity for some time to come and lower prices. This, in turn, could lead to what we call the long aftershock. the long aftershock is where you get a downturn in investment on the upstream side and the downstream side that eventually leads to a retightening of the oil market. Despite the downward trend in demand, we could see prices spike up quite a bit in 3 to 5 years. By spiking up, I mean going to a much higher level longer term based on the fundamentals, based on the fundamentals of demand and supply. So I'm not talking about the current price situation. But 3 to 5 years out from now, potential for much higher prices. In fact, we see about half, in the next 5 years, we see about half of the potential growth in global oil supply at risk of being deferred or postponed. So this means we could see a substantial reduction in the pace of supply growth because of decisions made this year and possibly into next year that slow capacity growth. So the bottom line on the liquid fuels market, one, peak oil is here. Peak oil is here, at least in light-duty vehicle transport fuels in North America and Europe. And it will lead, we believe, to a slower pace of long-term demand growth than we've generally seen in the past 10 to 20 years. But that doesn't mean we're in the clear in terms of prices because of this long aftershock on the supply side, because of the possibility of lower investment, lower capacity growth. Okay, let me switch to my second point, and this is the game changer. What could we see change around the world that could lead to a different paradigm in the transportation market and the oil market? Here it is, the low-cost electric car in Asia, a car that is about $5,000 to $10,000, and it's all electric. Is this going to happen tomorrow? No, it's not going to happen tomorrow. There will be an evolution. We've seen low-cost cars with internal combustion engines emerge in Asia. We'll see a move towards hybrid gasoline electric cars in Asia. Then we'll move to plug-in electric hybrid vehicles there. And ultimately battery-powered electric vehicles in Asia. Now, many of us look to this demand for mobility in Asia and say, oh, my goodness, how can we possibly satisfy that demand? It's inevitable that demand for mobility will be there as incomes rise. As surely as the sun rises, as income rises, people want greater mobility. But it doesn't mean that that desire for mobility will be satisfied in the same way as it was in the past. Low-cost electric vehicles are much simpler to produce than the traditional internal combustion engine. Far fewer moving parts. And the key is scale, mass scale of production. What Henry Ford did to the automobile industry a century ago, or thereabouts, may not have been quite 100 years ago, roughly speaking 100 years ago, he brought mass production techniques to the vehicle industry. If you apply that to low-cost electric cars in Asia, you could bring the cost down substantially. We're already seeing a preference for electric vehicles in Asia. We're already seeing a preference. Electric two-wheelers in China have begun to rival, in terms of sales, gasoline-powered two-wheelers in China. Part of this is driven by policy in specific cities in China, but we're seeing that trend in China right now, electric two-wheelers rivaling, perhaps even exceeding the sale of gasoline or combustion-type engines for two-wheelers. The buyers and the know-how for low-cost electric vehicles are in Asia. There's the potential for this low-cost electric vehicle technology to be viewed as a homegrown technology, something not imported from the West. To get the type of driving distance that would satisfy the need for mobility of a large share of the Asian population is nearly there. This, again, we're not talking about a technology that needs to fall down from outer space and change everything. Battery technology isn't too far away from where it needs to be to get 40, 50, 60 kilometers for a single charge for low-cost electric vehicles. So why Asia? Why are we saying Asia? Why not the United States? It could happen in the United States, could happen in Europe. We don't rule that out. But Western preferences for vehicles tend to be at odds with the attributes that one would generally ascribe to a low-cost electric vehicle. A counter-argument that we hear often is, gee, you know, you go to Beijing and you see the wealthy Chinese, they drive these big Buicks and other cars. They don't have an appetite for low-cost electric cars. There's no disputing that. The wealthy in China and many other places, those who have income similar to many Americans, yes, they do desire large vehicles like many Americans and Europeans do. But if you go to the countryside and you have someone who's been riding a bike or they had a donkey cart for a generation, you provide them an opportunity to upgrade to a low-cost electric vehicle, that is a major, major upgrade. And that's where the market is. If this is going to occur, it's going to occur in the more modest income segments of the emerging world, and China in particular. So I'll stop there, and just to recoup the two principal ideas, one, peak oil has arrived, and yes, you've heard it from someone at CIRA, and two, the low-cost electric vehicle does have the potential in the long term to be a real game changer in the energy market and the transportation market. Thank you.
Super. Thanks, Jim. Some interesting food for thought, particularly relative to contrasts of overall demand and pricing implications for the oil sector itself, and also for U.S. gasoline prices. Pleasure to welcome Robbie. Robbie, will you use slides? Do you want me to blank this out? What would you like to? Okay. I'm sorry. Mode. How's that?
Perfect.
Perfect. So, thanks. Pleasure to welcome Robbie Diamond. He's been referred to before, but he is the founder and president of Securing America's Future Energy, well-known name and speaker in Washington with a lot of ideas, and it's a pleasure to have him speak with us this morning. So, Robbie, please.
Thanks, Doug. I was sort of asked to be the cleanup speaker. So I didn't really know what everyone else was going to say before. So I've been sort of jotting down my notes, and everyone has basically said what I wanted to say. So I'll just pull it together. No, it's been really fabulous. I would say that I deserve a round of applause, but I only came from 34th in Wisconsin. So hold the applause. Except if you're talking about vehicles miles traveled, I deserve a huge round of applause, seeing I traveled very little distance. So I was sort of asked to bring the whole all the speakers back to the idea of energy security and why we're talking about this. As an organization, Securing America's Future Energy is a group of four-star admirals and generals, the heads of all our services and some of the regions, the combatant commands that we have around the world. And some CEOs of major corporations, mostly of consuming companies and also sort of transformative business leaders. And our chairmen are Fred Smith, who is the founder of FedEx, and General P.X. Kelly, the 28th Commandant of the Marine Corps. And so we come from this and look at the oil question and the energy challenges we face from an economic and a national security issue, but clearly understand the ramifications for climate change and how to bring those three things together. But I would just say a couple things. The three things I want to talk about is, as I was asked to do, is bring it back to the energy concerns we have as a nation and why this matters so much to the blood and treasure of the United States. Number two is talk a little bit about everyone's been talking about electrification. I'll talk about that, but focus a little bit more on the infrastructure side and what's needed, as well as some other fuel choices. And thirdly, about climate change and energy security and the relationship between the two and what needs to happen. You know, the first slide, and maybe this will be the only slide, although it's hard to read the numbers, the names, all you need to know is the colors. Basically, there's no free market for oil in the world, and I think we always have to remember that. 90% of our oil reserves are owned by national oil companies. And so everything in blue are national oil companies, and red are private oil companies. The first red, as you see all the way down the list in a small sort of a small amount of oil reserves held by them, oil and natural gas reserves, is ExxonMobil. So clearly the enemies we paint as big oil in the political debate in Washington, and when we bring the CEOs of oil companies every every few months or every couple of years to stand there and swear to why oil prices are high, they're really small oil. And it's not a defense of oil companies, but I think it's important to remember these facts. And so there's no free market for oil. And then when you put that into the dynamics of why it matters so much to us, one has to look, as Jim talked about, the supply supply and investment of current resources. And I think it's very important to note how much investment in current production has dropped around the world. It's dropped precipitously due to the economic environment. And so I think that is an important dynamic. As prices, or as we come out of our economic recession, I think it was called the Great Recession, one can worry, and Jim's numbers are correct, the amount of spare capacity is tremendous at the moment, but I think one has to be worried about oil and the pricing of oil, and we can talk about why prices have gone up so much recently, but that we strangle the recovery in the cradle. And I think oil, I think is the view of the CEOs in particular and the generals on at SAFE that, oil prices were the fuse that lit the match where we are today. Of course, the mortgage issues were the kindle that was lit, but oil prices were going up. Energy prices, the whole food and everything else were going up at the same time as people's mortgages were going up because of their arms. And if one looks at the total cost of the economy, it was the energy prices are vastly greater than anything that the mortgage mess cost the economy as a whole. I think the trade deficit is really critical to remember. Our oil dependence is a question of how much we need a year from countries around the world, and it is the largest piece of our trade deficit, over 50%. And so most of the time in Washington, we debate our policy with China and trade and NAFTA and the European Union, Mexico. Really, it's oil. And it's and the sad fact about that is that they're non-productive dollars. At least some of the goods we bring in from other countries, there's a productivity here. It is really it's really about waste. And if any household looked at their family budget and saw that over 50% was going to one area, they'd probably try to tighten that belt. And I think that is critically important. If we see the prices today, as Jim mentioned, they are delinked from the oil supply because there's so much spare capacity, but they're not delinked from the price on the dollar, and that matters to our deficit. And if one thinks about where our interest rates could go due to the government deficits and people wanting to raise lend us money around the world and us needing to give them more for that money and each dollar costs more, one can only think of where oil prices could go again, not based on the supply. And I think that is very, very important and a big challenge for the United States. And finally, we shouldn't forget the challenges and the problems in different countries around the world. So let's just continue to remember, in this graph you see in front of you, you see all these national oil companies, and we still have the same problem, which is you mentioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Russia, Saudi Arabia. Out of the 10 largest oil exporting countries, really only three are democracies. United States is if we look at the producers. I wonder if we have the producers. Well, anyway, so not a lot of stable democracies in there, and anything can happen around the world. What's amazing is with the spare capacity we currently have, even a conflagration with Iran. Would not there's more spare capacity to meet their entire supply in the world market. So I think that things are changing on that front, but volatility still makes a big difference. We have to remember where the oil is coming from. if one looks at oil, I wasn't going to show these slides, although I had them up here just in case, but now that I'm on it, look, I think it just so well demonstrates our problem, which is oil. We're the top oil consumer in the world. You know, U.S. oil demand, if you look at the bottom graphs, 69% in the left side is that big blue is for transportation fuels. But then one looks at the other slide, transportation fuel demand by mode, and if you can see why cars and light trucks matter so greatly to our problem, and those are the two big circles at 60% of our oil use. We've all talked about the demand for oil, and here let's go to the electric power sector. So. Look, unless we link up our oil need to our electricity, there's no windmills or solar that will have a difference, as Beth Osborne said, and I was very pleased that she commented on that. You know, usually you have Republicans who say we should become energy independent and we'll build nuclear power plants, and you have Democrats who say we should become energy dependent and we'll build solar and wind. The truth is neither of them will create oil independence until we link up the car to the grid. As we look at our oil, our electricity demand, only 2% is used for producing electricity. And so, but what electricity does provide from a security perspective is diversity of fuel sources, mostly of domestic and less volatile energy inputs. And so if one thinks about the holy grail, the problem is that you have basically an entire sector dependent on one fuel source, 97% of it's dependent on that fuel source with no alternatives. And at the same time, how do you solve that problem? It is through diversity of fuel sources. That, as Winston Churchill said, when he had to make the decision, should we turn the fleet of naval ships in Great Britain from coal, which they had a lot of supply of, to oil, he said, well, we'll find security and diversity alone. Now, at the time, he thought we'll own the countries that own the oil, and that then we'll have lots of them, and that will supply us our diversity. Well, this is just a little bit different than that, but there is still security and diversity alone, and that is why this is so important to what we're doing. And I think we have to keep our eye on that fuel diversity. But as people have noted here, the timelines are tremendously long, and so in the interim, from a security perspective, one should be thinking about using what you have as efficiently as you can, which is fuel economy, and then two is one should think about producing as much as you can domestically, which is the problem of the balance of payments I've discussed before, and some of the issues on the dollar. And so I think from electrification, that's why everyone sees electrification as such a holy grail. But I think a piece that I've discovered has been missing in the debate recently is there's sort of these two camps in the electrification. There's definitely a camp that talks about, look, we need to wait for the batteries. The batteries aren't totally there yet. This is great. We've just given $2 billion to battery investments in the United States. Those batteries will come online. There's $7,500 tax credit. People will buy the first cars. We'll have a million vehicles out there, and they'll plug them into their homes. And I would posit that that's a recipe for disaster. That is creating a niche market, a novelty item across the country with scattered vehicles everywhere. And I think the United States has to think much more systemically about the holistic systems that are required for our electric vehicles and to make sure that the infrastructure is coming online at the same time. Now, of course, there's the risk that the batteries never get there or the cars aren't there, and so to electrify all the United States at one time is too costly a proposition. But what I would posit is something like electrification ecosystems, as we've started to talk about. And this is really the notion that at the same time, the car, the battery, and the infrastructure has to be there. If one talks to the utilities, there are major concerns. Maybe as a whole, when people talk about how much electricity is on the market on the off-peak hours that could fill up our cars, it's less of a concern. But when one gets into the specifics of locations, so if someone, say, a lot of people had electric vehicles in one location and they went to the football game or the baseball game and there were charging stations and that substation wasn't equipped for all those charges, big problem. And, it only took a branch to take down the entire Northeast grid. And so what the country should really be thinking about now is investing in the infrastructure and dealing with these problems in very specific geographic locations and make sure that those vehicles, the first vehicles on the market, go there. Because we really are only going to have one chance to get this right. And there was an article in the USA Today in the last couple of days. It might have been today. Someone emailed it to me, which is the BMW put out their first plug-in electric cars in the United States. It's something like 500 cars. But no, it takes 23 hours to fill them up because they didn't have the fast charging, you know, the 240 volt hooked up to these houses. And it's going to take months and months and months. And so if people have a distance that they travel, they might only be able to use their car at once every 2 days. And so it's things like this that that matter a great deal, because if these cars come out and there's a great failure, as I've described, either at the football game or at the baseball game, or the charges aren't there, or the homes aren't equipped, or the work, they can't plug it in, I don't think we have many chances. And so I think there has to be a much more systemic effort and a thoughtful process on creating these electrification ecosystems and not just scatter these vehicles across the country, because the United States is behind many other countries on this idea of electrification. Look, in Israel, for example, they have over 2,500 charge spots. They don't expect the cars for another year and a half. Well, that's because they're starting to get ready for them, and it matters. Especially if the batteries are smaller in the beginning or don't have as much charge, people are going to need to fill up more often. And with electricity prices low, the ideal is that people will top off their vehicle not during the peak hours but also during the day. Just say something about algae-based biofuels. You know, I think that's a very important thing, and as this is about transportation, jet fuel is an important fuel to transportation, and I think that there is a great advance on hydrocarbon-based based biofuels, and I think that's really important for the country to start focusing on. So alcohol-based biofuels create the different needs, different flex vehicle needs, different infrastructure needs, but if one thinks about hydrocarbon-based biofuels that can work inside the existing infrastructure, such as creating jet fuel from algae, I think that is very promising. And one can then think about the United States as electric vehicles potentially being the smiley face of the United States, you know, the two coasts and down, biofuels in the center, and hydrocarbon-based biofuels, or biofuels that have a hydrocarbon-based molecular structure for our diesel and our jet fuel needs. And if we think about, you know, each energy source for its particular need, I think we end up in a better place. My final point to tie this all together is climate change and energy security. And both are totally related to one another, but both are separate and distinct. And so, you know, the policies are not always the same. I think Beth pointed that out, and others have as well. And we have to make sure that we have a transportation policy that is specific to our transportation needs and our oil dependence issues. And there'll never be a price on carbon that is so great to raise the price of gasoline to truly change our driving habits, patterns, and our vehicle mix. And so if that's the case, energy security can't be the stepchild of a climate change policy. When oil prices are high and everyone panics, I mean, who could believe that it was Nancy Pelosi that opened the outer continental shelf to oil production? Because the one thing you know about politicians is when the price goes up and there's ultimate panic, they're willing to do things they never had thought was possible before. And so one has to watch the oil problem we have very specifically with a very specific set of policies in the transportation bill and the transportation reauthorization bill. That bill needs to take energy security much more into account, as well as in our energy bills to deal with this with its own specific policies when we address climate change. But we must remember why we're doing this. And, you know, as you saw from the slide before, electric vehicles, hybrid electric vehicles, the difference between hybrid electric vehicles and all electric vehicles when it comes to global greenhouse gas emissions might not be so different, but when it comes to oil reductions, there's a dramatic difference. And I think that if we lose sight of that goal for the country, we will suffer tremendously. And so one has to make sure that we remember why we want electric vehicles on the road. And it's not just about the greenhouse gas emissions, but actually reducing our dependence is critically important. And I'd finish by positing that, you know, climate change policies, energy policies need to exist for 30, 40, 50 years. I mean, that's really the great challenge we have. It's having a sustainable policy over time. And if we continue to have oil price spikes due to falling supply or increasing demand or for whatever reasons or because we're held hostage by the countries that own it, our politicians will continue to change the policies all the time. And so you might get a climate policy today, a price spike tomorrow that has nothing to do with the climate policy, and then the next week, you know, it's all over. They've changed their mind because the public has blamed one for the other. And so that is why I think dealing with the oil issue is so critical. I think because it could become the sort of the weight around the neck of climate policy. And so I think people who are very interested in climate policy should really hone in on this and should consider the notion of the domestic supply we need in the interim, the increased efficiency that we need to make sure we're using that oil, that domestic production efficiently, and then finally the transition off oil as the only dominant fuel we have. So those are my thoughts. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, all three speakers. I have a couple of just quick comments to think about as we formulate questions. First off, clearly a number of fuel options, everything from the plethora of liquid fuels to changing the fuel source per se, i.e. electricity, and then, of course, what the electricity fuel mix looks like. Vehicle options as well. I think there are a number of those across the table. That we really need to look at in much more detail and understand what those offer both short-term and long-term. We didn't talk a lot about consumer choice options and thinking about services and infrastructure. I think that there's a pretty fruitful ground there for some dialogue, particularly relative to some of the investments that are coming forward relative to train and other mode-shifting options for the U.S. And then fourth, I think mindful dialogue about policy and the policy options which are in front of us, because I think that it is a very complex diagram, complex environment to think about both short-term, medium-term, and long-term, and to think about whether or not climate trumps security or security trumps climate. And then so within that, I'm not quite sure how we reach a balance in terms of a portfolio, and maybe what we need to do is just have priorities, but I'll leave that for dialogue. I'm going to, exercise my right to pose the first question, and let me do this to Jim, if I may. Is the forecast that you put forward inclusive of the current policy environment, and does it include a climate policy component of it? Because what I notice, and I'm not sure if it's true, is that your forecast is very divergent from Anup's and what he put forward in terms of what we would have to do in order to meet climate contributions from the transport sector. Let me start there, and then I'll open it up to the audience.
One difference between what I think the slide I put forth and Anup's was we weren't trying to portray what should happen. We're just trying to portray what we think will happen. And it does take into account the fuel economy standards that have that were in the 2007 energy bill. The picture you saw does not take into account the impact of the recently increased standards, but because of the long time it takes to turn over the vehicle fleet, you visually on that chart you wouldn't see a big difference. And the trends there. Maybe a little bit towards 2025, 2030, but not a big difference in that time frame.
Okay, thank you. Okay. I'll repeat Frank's recommendations, please. Please identify yourself, and please, if you would, if you do your best to ask a question, that'd be great. Thank you. Bob, I'll start with you because you were encouraged at the beginning.
A point of clarification. Yeah. On slide But I was surprised to see that the grams of CO2 per kilometer was actually less for the electric hybrid with coal than it was for gasoline. And I was wondering if that was, in fact, true. I mean, that has a lot of implications for everything we were talking about here. On your chart, it showed that it was about, I don't know, somewhere around 150, 130 grams per, you know, kilometer, whereas gasoline was further out to the right on that chart, you know, up higher, too, because it was petroleum. So that was my point of clarification.
On this slide
right here, I think, you have that bar at the bottom where you have, I can barely read it, but you had coal, average grid, and natural gas, and those are around 80 to 100 grams CO2 per kilometer, but the IC engine, the spark ignition, is up there around 160, 170 or something. And so I was just wondering, where in the electric system do we get the extra efficiencies? Because I thought those things were actually the reversed. So I haven't actually done my own calculations.
Sure. What's happening in this particular chart is the reason you see such a big greenhouse gas emission from a coal-only grid, I mean, not just that because it's coal-only, the problem with the current technology assessment on the electric vehicle side is the batteries that we have and the ones that we are getting are all high-power density batteries. We quite don't have, and quite frankly, I'm not sure the next generation of lithium-ion are the batteries we can actually use for real electric vehicles. That requires a science breakthrough. It's really, I'm not confident that the battery systems that are coming. So what they do is they add a lot of weight onto the vehicle in order to have the kind of energy storage you need to get down to 300 miles or so range. Now, as Jim said, you know, if you built a vehicle with a different attribute in mind, if you only want to charge and go 60 or 80 or 100 kilometers rather than 200 or 250 kilometers, you may be able to take off some of that weight and cost of the vehicle to reduce it down. Secondly is just the point that we do need the grid to clean up its carbon content if we are to go on electrification side for either energy security or climate change reasons. And so really without having cleaned up the grid, as this chart shows, the benefits are only on the petroleum side, not on the climate side.
No, this grid actually says we get benefits on both by going to an all-coal grid with electric vehicles. So, I mean, unless I'm reading it completely wrong here, is that you have more petroleum consumption and you have more emissions with the gasoline fleet than you would if you went to an electric fleet based on pure coal. And that's a very profound message.
You want to be on the lower left-hand corner of this diagram.
You're moving in that direction.
Yeah.
Well, for the point of hybrid, that's the case, but the electric vehicle coal is still out past the gasoline. You probably can't read it, the bottom is the electric vehicle coal right here. Compared to the gasoline up here, so it's still more. But then plug-in hybrid gets better. And that's where I think he's talking about the battery technology being lighter.
Interesting chart. Let's go on. So we'll go here and then in the back, and I'll move left. Okay.
A question on that chart, too. What's whose well-to-wheels numbers are you using for that, please?
Oh, these are the numbers from On the Road in 2035. That's our MIT study that I was a part of. So you can find the details. I guess if we make the slides available somewhere, you'll have or you can just Google On the Road in 2035 and you'll get it.
We'll go here and then I'll come back to you all. So go ahead.
I was curious about what you're showing for the hydrogen-powered vehicle. Some people say hydrogen-powered vehicles make no sense. You start off with electricity, you convert it to hydrogen, you convert it back to electricity, and you wind up with a lot less electricity than you started out with. And probably you'll need 3 or 4 times as much energy to drive a hydrogen-powered vehicle. as a pure battery electric. And you've got weight problems with both. You've got all sorts of scientific problems with both. But actually, the electric vehicle has fewer. So now I notice you're using natural gas and direct reformation. But still, if you're doing that, you know, if you're using natural gas, electric vehicles still use natural gas. No one has ever explained to me what is the advantage of a hydrogen unless you just cannot do electric, battery electric.
A simple answer is we don't know what is going to happen in the future. And we do know that we need to reduce oil consumption dramatically. We do know we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions dramatically. And we know that while the internal combustion engine can improve a lot, it only gets us so far. So the reason why a lot of people are working really hard is that some of these options may not pan out. And we need to be working really hard from now on that pathway, which will take a lot of infrastructure, a lot of vehicle technology development. Now, there are certain companies that believe that actually know the hydrogen fuel cells will actually offer that pathway because they're skeptical, having been burned with the batteries in the past, that the promise of those ever-efficient batteries may never be realized, in which case they are kind of only left with this additional pathway that has no petroleum use at all. So that's really the reason for the diversity perspective, that it's still in play.
I'm going to go here and then work this way. Then I'm going to come back in the front and then back to the right. So go ahead.
Hi, I'm Patrick Surface. I'm Vice President of the National Hydrogen Association. And thanks very much for the gentleman from the Treasury Department for the nice segue. If you don't mind, I would respond to your question and say that the efficiency of producing hydrogen from natural gas and using it in a fuel cell vehicle, when you look at the whole process compared to producing electricity from natural gas and using an electric vehicle, you actually do have a slight efficiency gain. You end up using less natural gas with hydrogen to get miles traveled. If you want more detail on that, I'd be happy to talk to anyone about that afterwards. It's the whole process. But my question was, I was actually going to thank a lot of the speakers for pointing out some of the challenges to battery electric vehicles, because I don't think that that's being talked about enough. As you mentioned, we're enamored with these battery vehicles, or at least plug-ins. There are a lot of challenges. To what role do you think hydrogen fuel cell vehicles can play in the electrification of our transportation system here, with the fact that, you know, when you look at the infrastructure challenges that the last speaker just talked about, there are infrastructure challenges with electrification for batteries, and there's infrastructure challenges for hydrogen, maybe even arguably equally so. To what role can hydrogen fuel cells, which do produce electricity, play a role in that electrification of the transportation industry?
Would you like to anyone take it on?
The simple answer is right now the technology crystal ball doesn't allow us to say how big a role that'll be. It does appear that it'll have some role at some level, but then when you compare these two really uncertain long-term technology pathways, remember that if you apply a level of optimism to assess one technology, you should try to use the same level of optimism for another technology. So if you're really confident that the cost of a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle will come down, the infrastructure will be there, the storage problem will be solved, then you have to sort of give the same benefit of the doubt to its competitor that says, oh, you will have a better battery pack and you will have an electric infrastructure. So with that in mind, I mean, these technologies will have to sort of, on a very long-term pathway, when we talk about the later half of this century, will have a role to play.
Yeah, I would add, although I said there are great challenges, and I do agree, and I think we shouldn't rule out any one technology. Look, there's only two national infrastructures in the United States. One is electricity, and one is gasoline. And so if one looks at the it's not a transformative change we need when it comes to electric vehicle infrastructure, but rather a focused understanding about the changes in the way we will use electricity and the need to take what are the wires we have over our heads at all time and bring them to different locations we might not have had before. So I think that the challenges are great in some ways, but it exists across the country, and tends to be an advantage. I was struck when I deal with Fred Smith of FedEx. You know, there's a guy who created an industry from scratch, and people always say to him about the transformative change. You know, he says there's no transformation needed when it comes to electrification in many ways because it does exist across the country. It's a matter of changing and moving the plugs and making sure that our electricity grid can handle it. So I think that is an advantage, an inherited advantage ultimately. But like I said, and I do agree that we don't know the outcome by 2050 yet.
Let me offer just a couple other comments just quickly on that one. One, first off, is I think there is a natural gas infrastructure too. So I don't know if you were putting that with the electricity or not. But on hydrogen vehicles themselves, I mean, there are, of course, demonstration efforts going on and small fleets working forward. There's a fair amount of research. There's actually a significant amount of research both on the production side, the storage side, and the use side. There is also a significant amount of synergy when one looks at direct production of hydrogen from electricity in distributed networks, for example. And thus, I guess my takeaway is that while we ask technology-specific questions, I think we need to reset our expectations based upon the fact that we have lived essentially with an internal combustion engine environment for the last 100 years, approximately, and that there will be a portfolio. We should expect a portfolio of technologies and solutions going forward. And so it's not just, how do we talk about hydrogen versus a battery vehicle? It's not a versus. They're going to compete for market share, yes, but I think our expectation has to be that we're going to see a blossoming of options in front of us and, in fact, a very powerful arbitrage opportunity for consumers as well as for companies to invest in different technology pathways. So we had one over here, and then I'll keep circling back. So I see you. I'm going to come here, and then I'll come back over to you, David. Please remember to introduce yourself and state your institute, if you would. Please.
Hi. I'm Tony Andrews with the Congressional Research Service. First, I want to compliment you on a very enlightening discussion. I'm very pleased to have had the opportunity to hear it. The question that I have, or the observation, is that when we talk about transportation, we don't go far enough. There's the baseload transportation that I would say is transportation for commerce purposes, things like over-the-road trucking, versus what I would also term peak transportation, which is what the average individual thinks of. Gets in his car, starts it, drives to work a few miles, turns it off. Base load is really important. I don't see any discussion of how some of these alternatives really fit into base load transportation, other than to qualify that to say that to an extent it already exists within rail transportation. That's hybrid technology, and it's demonstrated its use, but you have to look at it very carefully when we talk about the generation of electricity. It's generated on board. So I have not seen any solution to replacing the current, over-the-road truck as it currently exists, other than with suggestions that natural gas might play a role in that, but I'm very skeptical.
Robbie?
Yeah.
Can I say one other thing, and this is kind of in defense of the hydrogen fuel cell.
If it's a question.
Well, it is. It is. I'm kind of musing on how AAA is going to fit into this, because I can see that if my hydrogen fuel cell vehicle runs out of hydrogen, AAA might show up to refill it. I don't see how that works with a plug-in. If somebody has an answer to that, I'd be...
So I would just say about trucks, as a group, yes, there is no simple solution for trucks. You will move some freight to rail. That will not solve all your problems. We need to make our trucks much more fuel efficient, and right now both EPA and the Department of Transportation are working on that. There could be some electricity used in these trucks, And then finally, I talk what I said before about algae into fuel. I think diesel has a future, biodiesel through algae and other other types of fuels like that. So I think it's very important that we do have fuel economy on our trucks. The only country in the world that has it right now is Japan. The United States, I think, has moved forward in the last energy bill by doing this. And so in the next couple of years, probably even sooner in this administration, we'll hear about new standards for the trucks. I think what's difficult in this country with trucks is that the back of the truck and the front of the truck, the cabin, are owned by the same people in many instances. Where in Europe and other countries, you own a truck and they both own the front and the back. So how do you deal with the fuel efficiency of our truck fleet is going to be really interesting in that way. On your question about hydrogen and AAA coming to refill the. I think those are big questions, and certainly some people are trying to deal with that range extension, as it's called. You've got the Shiagassi model of the fuel switch, the Better Place model. You've got the people who think there's going to be quick recharging gas station type of scenario, and I do think that that is an open question.
Just a shameless plug for the ICCT on the heavy-duty vehicle fuel economy. We've been running a pretty large program with the Southwest Research Institute on evaluating the fuel economy options for the heavy-duty vehicles, and the report will be out in a couple of months' time. But the potential is huge, up to order of about reducing it in half over a decade's time frame.
Dave.
Thank you, Doug. I'm David Girard from the Rockefeller Foundation, formerly DAS for International Policy, Trade and Investment at DOE. See many of my colleagues. Congratulations to you, Doug, and the panel. The question I have is the one we seem to always shy away from, which is what kinds, if we take the 2050 83% in the Waxman-Markey bill and work backwards, what kinds of carbon price, whether through cap and trade or through taxes or standards, what kind of policies of that nature will be required to bring it down to that level? Because there's often a disconnect between these targets and the policies required to achieve them. And, for example, in the MIT work on coal, John Deutsch and Ernie Moniz came up at $30 a ton of CO2 as the price to make carbon capture and storage begin to penetrate the electric power sector. So I'd like to see some serious analysis and evidence that will get us there from here, and what kind of policies, especially pricing policies, are going to be needed.
Anybody want to comment on that one? It's quite complicated. But,
it's something we look at quite consistently. And when you look at you view most of the proposals that are out there, and the price ranges for carbon dioxide emissions that they're suggesting, especially in say the 10 to 20 year time frame, if you translate that into the additional price for a gallon of gasoline, it's not something that is going to unilaterally motivate consumers to change behavior. It's pennies, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 cents a gallon. Now, that can matter to that. You add that up, that can be a big number in terms of revenue, but in terms of changing behavior, it seems to be too low for that.
Yeah, just Jim is absolutely right. And once you take that number, like $30 per ton of CO2 or $100 per ton of carbon, that's a quarter of gasoline tax per gallon. Now variation we have in a year is much bigger than that, so it just swamps it out.
I think you've been waiting very patiently. If we could bring a microphone up in the front. We'll take two here, and then one last over here. And is someone going to – okay. And then a final question back here, and then I think we're going to wrap up. All right.
Dick Venato with the Science Technology Policy Institute. This electrification scares the hell out of me. First of all, you talked about electrification in Asia. That means more electricity in Asia, particularly China with coal and India with electricity they don't have. I don't see the solution point with that, and I certainly don't see how it's going to deal with the climate issues in any kind of way. And then you look at the implications in the U.S. We already have very stressed electric grid systems. Huge investments are needed to support the grid the way it is. So I think electrification is a chimera rather than a solution. I think we have to look at some alternatives.
Well, I may make a quick response to that. I mean, I think, one, we have to think about the infrastructure change out, not only in the liquid fuels, but also in the electric sector. One of the clear things that's coming from the dialogue in this administration, which is very collective across the agencies, is the need for a comprehensive transmission planning framework and set of both not only a technology perspective but also a policy perspective to look at how that electricity sector needs to change. And if it's going to accommodate more demand from the transportation sector, if I can use that as an sector, that needs to be brought into bear.
Yeah, I think if you were to extrapolate based on current trends, assuming the electricity from coal-fired generation is 70% or so of Chinese power generation, that's what it is today, and we assume the same in 2030, it certainly has implications for CO2 emissions, big implications. But I wouldn't necessarily assume things will stay static. One, the whole electricity of the transportation fleet, it has one big implication that I don't think we've talked about today. It's very difficult to move towards a less carbon-intensive environment in the next 20, 30 years without nuclear playing a bigger role around the world. So yeah, I mean, you're raising a very good question, and the answer is, nuclear will probably have to play a bigger and bigger role around the world if the world is going to move to a less carbon-intensive environment in the next 20, 30 years.
So I'm normally not an advocate, but I'll put a shameless plug in for the second world in the institute that I work in, which is renewables, so it will also play a larger role. We have one here and then a last question. Can they be very short, please, since we're eating into your lunch hour?
Slade Gorton, I'm one of your afternoon panelists, but on a different subject, only Mr. Diamond even so much as mentioned petroleum from algae. I was fascinated that the ICCP thing did not even have it on that chart. And yet here you have something that requires no new infrastructure in refineries, pipelines, or automobiles, doesn't compete with agricultural land or for fresh water, reduces CO2 emissions by two-thirds in its full cycle, and is hugely scalable here in the United States for energy independence. Why was it ignored by two panelists and only mentioned in passing by Mr. Diamond?
It was not ignored, per se. It's included in that whole mass of biofuels, about 40 billion gallons or so, that could be produced from any source. As such, I guess as to scale and the technology that is required to do it, it's still in its infancy. So we'll see when we actually get a lot bigger examples of plants producing not a few hundred gallons, but a few hundreds of millions of gallons in the next few years. But I'll let Robbie and Jim.
Yeah, I'm not part of the anti-algae lobby, certainly not. It's one of the possibilities that's out there that could lead to much more efficient production of biofuels, but it's not something that we've pinned our outlook on.
Your attributions actually are correct. So at NREL we had an algae program for decades, about 20 years ago. It was cut out when budgets got tight, and our research program focused then on cellulosic ethanol. But that's being revamped. Our algae program is being revamped, in fact, with a fair amount of interest from the oil and gas companies themselves because they do see the attributes of it. And that's just one other potential pathway. There are, as Frank put up, multiple different fuels pathways, many of them with more attractive features than an alcohol pathway. And so I think it's worth something to discuss. So we have one last question before lunch.
This is going to be incredibly brief. I'm Darren Lovas with the Natural Resources Defense Council. And Anoop, I'm curious as to why your graph showing the different vehicles only included one blend level, E10 for cellulosic and corn, as opposed to, say, E85 or some other blend levels as well.
No particular reason for ignoring that. I mean, you can work out the numbers pretty easily from E85. And so this was not intentionally leaving it out. It just gets crowded once you have that many dots there.
All right. Please join me in thanking the panelists, and we'll go to lunch.